Ku'u Iluna, please rise. Auhea oko eko ka aha, inahe kuliana imua okea aha ho'okolo kolo kie kie hanohano okomoko aina o Hawaii. Inaoi mai, imalio mai, ilohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho ilalo. Please be seated.
Velina. Maka mukupuni o Oahu I ka moku o kona e ano ka ko ma ali o lani hale. Greetings. On the island of Oahu in the district of Kona, we are gathered here at ali o lani hale. Please call the case.
Case number SCEC-26-0000585. Natalie Iwasa et al. Plaintiffs versus Scott Nago et al. Defendants. And case number SCAP-26-0000550, Trevor R. Ozawa, Plaintiff Appellee versus Chad Kadoda et al., Defendants Appellees, and Thomas Waters, aka Tommy Waters, Defendant Appellant. Arguing for Plaintiffs Natalie Iwasa et al., Thomas Otake. Arguing for Plaintiff Appellee, Trevor Ozawa, Deidre Marie Iha. Arguing for Defendant Appellee, Chad Kadoda, in his official capacity as Acting City Clerk of the City and County of Honolulu, Duan Ping, Deputy Corporation Counsel. Arguing for Defendant Appellee, Scott Nago, in his official capacity as Chief Election Officer of the State of Hawaii. Arguing for Defendant Appellant Thomas Waters, aka Tommy Waters, Joseph Stewart. Representing herself, Defendant Tara Malia Gregory. Argument on the merits.
Aloha, Awina La, good afternoon. Please be seated. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. And I'd like to welcome our substitute justices in this case. Judges Michael Sung, Peter Cahill, and Peter Kubota. Mahalo for joining us today. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. The court has allowed 40 minutes for each side. And just to confirm, Mr. Stewart and Mr. Otake, you each intend to argue for 15 minutes and have reserved 5 minutes each for rebuttal. Ms. Chang and Mr. Pang, you will argue for 5 minutes with a 1 minute warning light. And Ms. Marie Iha, you will argue for 25 minutes with a 5 minute warning light. And Ms. Gregory, you will argue for 5 minutes with a 1 minute warning light. We will now proceed. Mr. Stewart, please proceed.
Good afternoon, justices, court staff.
Could you please raise the microphone?
My apologies.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, justices and court staff. May it please the court, my name is Joseph Stewart. I'm here on behalf of defendant appellant Thomas Tommy Waters. I'd like to once again express my gratitude, as I have, I think, every time I've been in this room, for the opportunity to address you today. The issue before this court, I think, is relatively simple, despite the significant amount of briefing that's occurred. And I believe the starting point, as almost always is the case, is to start with the language of the charter itself, and specifically the requirement of Charter Section 3-102, which states that no person shall be elected to the office of council member for more than 2 consecutive 4-year terms. We submit that the only interpretation that gives meaning to every single word of that charter provision would be to find that Mr. Waters' partial term of when he was elected with less than 3 years and 8 months left in the first term that he served to be a 4-year term, which would necessarily require a reversal of the circuit court's decision. Essentially, the basic point we make is that a four-year term means just that. It's 4 years. It can't start midway into a term of 4 years. In this case, the election at issue occurred in April of 2019, when the four-year term was supposed to start on January 2nd of 2019. That's not a four-year term. That's something less than a four-year term. We all understand that from a basic mathematics standpoint. I believe it also is applicable from a plain meaning interpretation standpoint.
Mr. Stewart, the opposing side argues that it doesn't say served 4 years. It says elected to a four-year term. And it's really a question of plain reading how you define a four-year term. Judge Ashford in the circuit court on the declaratory action said you are required to read the entire charter, all pertinent provisions. And there's only two types of terms. There's the four-year term, and then there's the vacancy term to which a successor is chosen. So I understand your main argument, but I think it's not just those the language in that one sentence in section 3102. Can you address the question of why you think this is there aren't two terms in the charter?
Okay,
as Judge Ashford
found. Happy to do so, Your Honor. The initial point would be that I would say that you would need to at least be capable of serving four-year terms, or it couldn't be a four-year term. So to say that we're not saying it's about service, it's about what you're elected to. And what you're being elected to is a four-year term, not a term of any length, not a term of less than 4 years, not a term of more than 2 years, but less than 4 years. Those are all a different, would require basically an amendment of the charter provision. So that would be my first response. My second response would be to say that the other language of section 3-102 talks about the fact that there's a regular term that starts on January 2nd. The use of the term regular from a canon of statutory interpretation standpoint contemplates that there is also an irregular term, something that doesn't start on January 2nd. So we would submit that the possibility of somebody being elected midway through a term with less than 4 years, where they're not capable of being elected to a four-year term because the election occurs with less than 4 years remaining on the term, does not constitute an irregular term. Regarding the circuit court's interpretation that somehow there was a 3-102 and 3-105, and that these are the only two things that contemplate, I think there's a couple of problems, I think, with that. First of all, the fact that 3-102 specifically addresses the concept of an irregular term, which certainly implies that there could be something else, and that there could be a non-regular or irregular term, as I mentioned. The other thing is that the circuit court's interpretation of 3105, I believe, infers a requirement that doesn't exist. 3-102 doesn't distinguish why a partial term that is served after somebody else had been elected does not count, but a term of less than 4 years that you're elected to when nobody else had been previously elected does count as a four-year term. In fact, they're the same. And if you look at the facts, that interpretation essentially would ignore the fact that there are three known examples of former council members, rather, who were elected in three consecutive elections and served more than 8 years.
But in those situations, and you can get into what the details of them are, but in each of those other situations, they were succeeding somebody who had already started a term, right? So whether it was because of death or resignation or what have you, in those instances, they were succeeding somebody under Section 3105's language to fill out the remainder of that term. Is that a misreading of what happened?
I think it's an accurate factual statement, but I think the context that somehow there's a distinguishment on either the requirement of 3102 or 3105 that somebody who is elected in the midway of a term to succeed somebody else versus somebody like Mr. Waters, who is elected midway of a term to succeed a vacancy, that those should be treated differently. That's not in 3102, and that's not in 3105. So I think that that would be essentially a legislative rewrite, and was by the circuit court in order to make that determination, because that distinction is not made in 3102 as to what constitutes a four-year term. 3105 doesn't say, and furthermore, these shall not constitute four-year terms, but anything else shall be a four-year term, even if it's less than 4 years.
Well, you know, one of the things, and I don't want to take up all of your time with my question, I want to certainly allow others, but the circumstances in this case, I mean, just to be clear, this court invalidated the November 2018 election because of ballots being counted that shouldn't have been counted, and the margin was 22 votes, right, from
Correct.
The November election, and the votes in question was 350 votes, and because it couldn't, we couldn't determine, or this court couldn't determine how to uncount those votes, it said invalidate and have pursuant, they sent it to the governor, they sent the judgment to the governor to call the new election, right, and it was only these two candidates again. It wasn't a full replay of an entire open seat. So isn't that different than what happened in those three examples that you're referencing?
I agree that there is a factual difference. I'm saying I don't see as a matter of law that that difference is recognized differently between 3102 and 3105.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. It seems to me that below there seemed to be have been an assumption that 3105, the vacancy term, can only exist if it's a if the successor is succeeding somebody that's already in office. Let me ask you, what if a council member is elected in November and then unfortunately dies on New Year's Eve, suddenly dies before the council member is sworn in on January 2nd? When the regular term was to start. What happens then? Is the position vacant under 3105?
Our position is that 3105 doesn't distinguish the reason, or delineate rather, the reasoning as to why there's a vacancy.
It just and the circuit court, and it appears that Mr. Ozawa, I believe below, was arguing that, and it appeared to have been quoting from the case of Mink versus Pua, which discussed, gave examples of how a vacancy might occur. But this court did say, it says the key word is the word successor, and necessarily means the same in all cases of vacancies, no matter how they occur. And 3105 does not delineate how vacancies occur. Correct?
That's correct.
So vacancies can occur even if a person is not sworn in on January 2nd.
And we would submit that's exactly what happened.
And in terms of the definition of successor that's quoted in Mink versus Pua, it does not restrict it to succeeding someone that is in office, right?
I would agree 100%. That's exactly what happened here. Was Mr. Ozawa was the incumbent, and there was an election, and he was determined to have the most votes until this court stepped in. And at that point, nobody was certified, and therefore there was nobody to succeed other than Mr. Ozawa as the predecessor. Well,
no one was sworn in on January 2nd, right. 2019.
And so that created a vacancy. And if you look at actually...
And the vacancy was created when?
At the
when this court issued its decision, our opinion, on January 25th of 2019?
No, I think the vacancy...
That's how the city council addressed it, right?
Right.
They said a vacancy was created because of this court's opinion. Basically ordering a new election.
Which was ordered pursuant to 3-105, and then Mr. Formby was appointed.
Well, this court did not address 3-105 because 11 HRS 11-174.5 says that if we order a new election, we refer it to the governor to call the special election.
Yes, Your Honor. My apologies. I was referring to the City Council's action,
right,
as reflected in Resolution 19-11, where it stated that it was going to call the special election pursuant to 3-105 for the election ultimately that Mr. Waters was elected. And it also stated that it was going to appoint Mr. Formby in a separate action as a temporary substitute, also pursuant to Section 3-105, which was the vacancy that you're talking about. So I think those actually all harmonize together in terms of the fact that there is no delineation as to what constitutes a vacancy, or that the term vacancy or successor is limited in any way to only people who die or resign or whatever the reason for the vacancy. We believe there's a vacancy, and that addresses the both the plain language and this court's prior interpretations.
Mr. Stewart, in the circuit court, one of the arguments you folks made was that the case was not properly before the circuit court. And I'd like you to address that specifically under HRS Section 12-8.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you. So 12-8 was enacted by the legislature to set up an orderly challenge process in terms of candidate eligibility. And we know that from looking at what the actual provisions of 12-8 are, as well as the legislative history. But specifically, it says that there are to be a timely resolution. So it sets forth a deadline by which you have to submit a challenge. It sets forth what individual stakeholders, what rights they have, what their appellate rights are in terms of going beyond the county clerk in this case. And the purpose of that ultimately is that we want to avoid situations, no disrespect to anybody, but like this, where voters had to vote in this election with uncertainty. These things should be resolved before. That's the purpose of 12-8.
You know, one of the interesting things I find about 12-8 is that it calls for the clerk in this instance to make a preliminary determination, right, of eligibility based on an objection, a proper objection under the statute. If the clerk finds that there's basis for disqualification, then the clerk's required to file that circuit court action. But if the clerk, as in this case, determines that there isn't a basis for disqualification, it does not require a filing of an action in circuit court. So, you know, I mean, that's what happened here, right?
Correct.
And so there was no filing by Mr. Kadoda in circuit court pursuant to 12-8. So the question becomes then, is the entire question left to the clerk in this instance as to qualification? Is that the last answer?
I believe that if we look at the terms of Section 12-8 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes, that's what the legislature intended. And the reason for that was to get resolution. In that sense, the 12-8 starts by saying that nomination papers shall be deemed valid, mm-hmm. meaning unless there's a challenge, it's valid. So a challenge has to be made under 12-8 in order to be effective. The reason why some parties are allowed legislative appeal rights, if you will, or not legislative, but the legislature allows for certain appeal rights, I think, under 12-8, it tells you exactly what they intended a registered voter to be able to do, what they intended the officer of a political party to be able to do, and what they intended the county clerk in this case, or the elections office, to be able to do. And we submit that there is no evidence that there was any legislative intent to give registered voters any appeal rights beyond what are expressly stated. And in that sense, we find it to be significantly different from a number of other cases where this court's implied a private right of action. In this case, it's much more like SHOPO, where UIPA does have a appeal process, which certain parties can avail themselves of, but not all parties, right? Because people who are aggrieved by disclosure don't have that right, but people who are aggrieved by non-disclosure do. This court found that was the legislative intent of the legislature to give remedies to some and not to others. And I would submit that the purpose of 12-8 is effectuated only if you give actual meaning to the intent of the legislature as to who can appeal, which is limited to, in this case, the clerk. I think my time is up.
Yes, your time is up. We'll now hear from Mr. Otake.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. In March of this year, Mr. Waters filed his nomination papers, and shortly thereafter, a citizen challenged the eligibility, and the city clerk followed 12-8 and quickly ruled on it and deemed him eligible, and we believe that was the right ruling. What happened next was 2 months passed, two very important months. The court's ruling was on April 7th of this month, this year. 2 months then passed. As the election got closer and closer, Mr. Ozawa then, in June, challenged the eligibility. The clerk, again, following 12-8, found Mr. Waters eligible. Mr. Ozawa then filed the declaratory action that we, our position is, was not allowed by law. Meanwhile, ballots were printed. Mr. Waters' name was on them. They're mailed on July 17th. 10 days later, after people had been voting for 10 days, the circuit court then deemed Mr. Waters ineligible. And the result was 8,654 voters of District 4 were then told their vote didn't count. I'm proud today to stand here representing 40 members of the community, voting members of District 4, proud to be their voice. And as their voice, I ask the simple question, how can anybody think that's okay? That this process, that 8,654 people votes didn't count. How can anybody in this building think that's okay? It all stemmed from, respectfully, Mr. Ozawa, and respectfully the circuit court, disregarding 12-8. 12-8 was in place to prevent this very mess. And this is a mess. That being said, I'd be remiss if I didn't say, although it's a mess that brings us here, I appreciate your time. This is a beautiful exercise of our democratic process, the third branch of government weighing in on a peaceful election challenge, and that's what we're doing today. To follow up on Your Honor's questions about 12-8, it's a fascinating issue, and I read all the cases on it because it is very interesting, and this is why I think it all works out. It has to do with the right that is being taken away by 12-8. If Mr. Ozawa has a right to run for election, and if that's going to be taken away from somebody, then 100% there should be judicial review, and the legislature mandated that. And it's different from the cases in, for example, the Keiki Inc. versus Mariyoshi case, where the statute was actually silent on if judicial review was allowable through a DEC action. 12-8 actually goes beyond that and mandates that there is judicial review if you're taking away the cognizable right of somebody's right to run for office. What did Mr. Ozawa respectfully use 12-8 for? Not to make sure he was eligible, not to exercise his right to run for office, but to essentially have the court help him decide who he would be running against. He didn't want to run against this. Well, I mean, I'm just saying, presumably if somebody didn't want to run against some person, they wanted to challenge eligibility, that's not a right under 12-8 that we should allow the courts to review. So the point is, because the right was the right of eligibility, that's why 12-8 limits judicial review to that. And that makes it very different from, you know, like the Keiki Inc. versus Mariyoshi case, more in line with the Travelers Inc. case we cited in the Shopo case.
Well, how about this? 12-8, and in the context of this case, the decision from the circuit court occurred before the first special election on August 8th, right? And so 12-8, I grant you, requires a very expedited time yes. period in which objections to nomination forms must be made. The clerk must make a preliminary determination within, I think it's 5 days.
Right.
Then if there's a disqualification determination, file within the circuit court within 7 days. And the circuit court must make a decision very quickly based on when a summons is served,
yes.
4 days after a return date on a summons. That's basically 16 days or so, I think,
correct.
Based on my count. So I can understand why you want that process to happen before the election.
Yes.
Now, you folks have brought a post-election challenge. Why can't we address that question of eligibility now?
So the post-election challenge under 11-372 is, as the language says, the complaint shall set forth any cause or causes that could cause a difference in the election result. And so that's why we're using this to suggest that the process that happened here, and Mr. Waters being deemed ineligible, and then the fact that even though he still came in second place, it would be the top, you know, the top two should, that's the result, the general should be involving Mr. Azar and Mr. Waters. So by not doing that changes the result. And so it's the reason why is because, again, 12-8 is provides a specific remedy to challenging eligibility.
You would agree that Mr. Ozawa could have brought this as a post-primary special election that runs concurrently with the primary challenge under 11-172 and 11-173.5 if there was, or anyone challenging the eligibility of a candidate could bring this as a post-election challenge.
That's a very interesting question, and I haven't thought much about that, but I would.
It does,
I would
say the complaint shall set forth, yeah, any cause or, right, causes such as, but not limited, right, to.
And so what I was about to say, although I haven't thought much about that, I would tend to agree with you, Your Honor, that because it does say any cause that could cause a difference in the election result. And, you know, the point is, a deck action in the middle of the election is not the way to handle this. I mean, that's the point. And on behalf of the community members, that's really, I mean, you know, obviously we my clients want and believe Mr. Waters is eligible. We agree with everything Mr. Stewart said on that front, in terms of statutory interpretation and all of those things. But the process where 8,654 voters are deemed now to have their vote not count cannot stand. On that issue, I wanted to just point out one thing on the issue of interpretation and all of that. Okay, here's the problem as I would suggest it to be. You know, I would submit that the exercise that the court should not be engaging in is trying to determine when is it enough. Is a term of 3 years, 6 months, does that not count? Does a term of 1 year and 10 months count? Does a term of, you know, 2 years and 8 months count, but 2 years and 10 months not? That is exactly what I don't think the court should be doing. So the bright line, as I see it, that should, in terms of the plain language and giving, you know, meaning to all of it and staying out of legislating from the bench, to me is very simple. If the election is before January 2nd, then you are elected to a four-year term. If the election is after January 2nd, then you're not. Other than that, it has to be a legislative fix, or else the court is trying to dive into guessing what the true intent was. On the issue of intent, we 100% embrace the general intent of the charters of the charter provision at issue. The general intent is term limits. But as always, we have to also look at the specific intent. Yes, the general intent was term limits, but the specific intent was two consecutive four-year terms. If the council and the public voted on, if they want something different, it's a legislative fix. The courts have to apply that plain language with that bright line, or else we're guessing as to when it would have been enough, which term should count. If, you know, so for those reasons, we stand by the fact that Mr. Waters is eligible. But the process, it cannot be that we are going to allow this chaos.
Yes. I have a question. Sorry to interrupt you. While we're on that thought, so you believe that anything less than a full four-year term means that he gets another run?
I believe that for the courts, the Supreme Court of our state, if they're going to weigh in on this, the only way to do it without legislating from the bench and guessing what the specific intent was, the only way for the courts to enforce that is to adopt a bright line that if the election is before January 2nd, then the person is elected to a four-year term. If the election is after January 2nd, then they're not. And I agree with you that there is issues with that. But presumably, you know, the problem is, if not, then we're right back to where I'm suggesting we shouldn't be, which is the court saying 3 years and 10 months doesn't count, but 3 years and 4 months does count, right? And
okay, so, but let's flip the script now. Say in the April election, Ozawa wins, okay? That he gets sworn in on April 2018.
Yes.
Or 2019, right? He wins. So he gets sworn in May 8, 2019. He doesn't have a full four-year term. So then does that mean that Mr. Ozawa has his first four-year term from 15 to 19? Then he has this, quote, vacancy term. And then he got two more after that. So you can go to 2031. That is the result that you wish us to reach?
Well, yes. And here's why. I understand there's any number of ways that could play out where somebody could get another, you know, for example, you know, I understand the dilemma here, right? But my point is it's a legislative fix, right? I'm assuming when Your Honor saw the ballots are going to be printed, I forget what the date is, but the state told us the date coming up. I'm hopeful this gets resolved before then so that the election in November settles it and we don't have to go. But the point is, there's any number of ways where this can continue to be problematic. And all I'm suggesting is the only way for the courts to intervene in this without legislating from the bench is by adopting that bright line. And after that, it's a legislative fix. The council can very easily clarify it, include different language, make it clear that no more than 8 years, you don't have to say anything about terms, or anything like that. And then the people can vote on it. And that's the legislative fix. But
go ahead.
So, but there was an election.
Excuse me?
There was an election that predated the swearing in that was supposed to take place. And that election occurred in November of 2018.
And then it was invalidated. And then there was.
But it was invalidated after the swearing in date by the Supreme Court, right?
I don't remember the exact date, but it was invalidated and the point is nobody was sworn in.
But nobody was sworn in. But then there's a subsequent election in April.
In April, yes.
Who decided who was going to be on that ballot?
Who decided who was going to be on the April?
Right.
My recollection is that the court did when in the Nago versus Waters versus Nago opinion.
It was set by the court. And there would only be two candidates on that ballot in April.
Because the November election was only those two, because they were the top.
They were the top two
in the
now.
July.
If this was a vacancy as a result of death, resignation, whatever, who could run on that ballot?
Anybody.
Any number.
Any number of people.
So that to fill that type of a vacancy is different than the vacancy that the Supreme Court ruled and named two candidates. In other words, this was not a free and open election, open to everybody.
It's not, because the challenge was to the November election. So
right.
The challenge was to the November election, and that's what was invalidated, and that's what the court said.
Right, but the point is that the analogy is that, well, this is like a vacancy, so therefore it's a vacancy election, but that would be open to any number of candidates in any slate. This April 2019 election was not open to anybody except Mr. Ozawa and Mr. Waters.
Right. But that's the issue with the charter section 3-105, is it doesn't differentiate between why there is a vacancy or anything like that. And so in this case, 3-105 was followed in 2018. There was a vacancy. Nobody was sworn in. Mr. Frombry was appointed, and then there was an election. And so I understand your questions, Your Honor, but I would suggest that under 3-105, it doesn't matter how we ended up there. It's just it's not that person was then not elected to a four-year term.
Go ahead. 3-102 says that the regular term of office of council members shall be 4 years, beginning at 12 o'clock meridian on the second day of January,
right,
following their election. So I believe the circuit court indicated that this is the term, that Mr. Waters' first term was a 3-102 term, not a vacancy term.
That was his thought.
But the language of this charter provision says that it's starts January, second day of January following their
right.
election. So if the election was in April 19th, how could the term have started in January 2nd? And I'm wondering, so what does that mean for Mr. Formby's appointment as the temporary replacement from February 4th, 2019 until May 8th? 2019? Did he not serve? Were his votes invalid?
And that's why, Your Honor, I agree with the point. And that's why I think if we're going to give credence to the plain language and the language, especially that you just read, the bright line is, was the election before January 2nd or was it after? I think that's the best way for the court to respectfully stay in its lane and not start to get into what the specific intent may or may not have been. I appreciate your guys' time in resolving this quickly. Again, this is a beautiful exercise of how we handle election challenges. So it's a pleasure
Thank
to be
you.
Here. Thank you. I'll save the rest of the time for rebuttal.
We will now hear from Ms. Chang, representing Scott Nagel.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Chief Election Officer Nagel takes no position on the merits of this case. In this election cycle, the Office of Elections' responsibility is to print and to mail ballots. And for that reason, the Office of Election requests that this court issue its ruling no later than September 4th, 2026, so that it may meet its statutory requirements to mail ballots to overseas and military voters no later than September 19th.
This court is required to rule by this Friday on this 11-173.5 challenge.
Even better. I welcome any questions the court may have. Otherwise, I thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I yield the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from Mr. Pang on behalf of City Clerk Chad Kadota.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Justices. We would like to address very limited provisions with respect to the election challenge and the allegations that the city clerk somehow did something wrong. City clerk issued notices that the court had disqualified candidate Waters and distributed that notice at the election sites and at the drop boxes. So we believe that there is no mistake that occurred and no justification to bring an election challenge.
I noticed in your answer the city indicates that you believe that the city's clerk's actions were well taken because the circuit court's order and final judgment were not stayed. Does that mean that the city considered the circuit court's decision to be a final judgment with res judicata effect?
No, Your Honor. The notice specifically said that Mr. Waters is disqualified. It described what we believe under the election laws, how to treat those votes.
Let me ask you, is there any reason the city clerk did find Mr. Waters to be eligible initially?
That's correct.
But you took that position in the circuit court, but then you did not appeal that decision.
The clerk decided not to appeal. We presented sufficient evidence to justify his reasoning, and the court disagreed with us, and the clerk decided not to.
But you decided not to raise the same arguments on appeal.
Well, the arguments are part of the record. They're still there, and the city clerk's notice that was issued did indicate that the circuit court decision was subject to appeal. So it notified everybody that he is disqualified, subject to appeal. We anticipated a stay. I apologize. We did anticipate a stay. There was questions before Judge Ashford about a stay. He did not want to rule on it orally. He invited people to file a stay, but none was issued. So the city clerk had to move forward based on the decision of the circuit court. We really couldn't wait for this. Another issue I'd like to address is potential remedies, whether you sustain the circuit court's decision or not. We ask that you validate the primary election or the first special election. Let the two eligible candidates move forward and let the general decide whether you agree that Mr. Waters should be disqualified or not. Nobody challenges anything with respect to the vote counting, the collections of the votes. And with respect to disqualification, death, or withdrawal, the statutes actually contemplate that. So it tells us that once the clerk finds out about a disqualification in this case, it should provide notice, and the votes cast for the disqualified person or person who has died should be counted for purposes of moving on to the next election. So with that, we ask that the court, no matter what the decision is, that you validate the primary election and let us move forward as the as the two most eligible candidates.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We will now hear from Ms. Marie Iha on behalf of Mr. Ozawa.
Good afternoon, Acting Chief Justice McKenna, Justice Ginoza, Your Honors. I'm Deirdre Marie Iha, appearing for Trevor Ozawa. With me today is Matthew Ezer and Kelly Wong. I'd like to organize my argument based on the questions the court has already asked to my opponents. When Mr. Waters' counsel suggested that there needs to be a bright line rule, respectfully, there is one. Their arguments about Section 3102 are based on language that is not there. It says elected to a four-year term. Justice Ginoza, you asked questions about that earlier. It says that for a reason, because that is the bright line rule. If you are elected to a four-year term, then the whole term counts against you. We have authority from other jurisdictions and other examples in Hawaii law. A term is a set period of time. And standing here today, I can tell you the exact start dates of every city council election for the next 100 years if they don't change the law. Those terms do not move. What they're talking about is Mr. Waters' tenure in office, how long he served, not how long the term is. Justice McKenna, you asked about the election happening after in that term. I believe the charter itself answers that question. If you look at Charter Section 13-116(1), which we quoted on page one of our brief in the transferred appeal, that defines the elections by which the council members are elected as held in conjunction with the primary and general elections of the applicable year. And then the Hawaii Constitution and Hawaii statutes together tell us, as we know, everyone in this room knows, the primaries are conducted in August, the general election is in November. So when the charter is referring to regular terms starting January 2nd after the election, that is what they're talking about.
The election was in April, not in December.
Yeah, the April.
And 102 does say that the regular term starts January 2nd after, following the election.
I understand, Your Honor. However, like I said, I don't believe the term moved. The city council elections, like a lot of other provisions of law, have staggered terms.
And I understand. Yep. But you're saying there, I understand your argument to be that this is not a vacancy term under 3-105. Is that correct?
Among other things, but yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And is it your argument that a vacancy term under 3-105 can only exist when a council member who started a regular term on January 2nd is for some reason unable to complete the term?
Not quite. I would say that they were elected to a four-year term. So your original hypothetical you asked earlier, where unfortunately...
No, can 3-105 can apply even if the person is not in office. Are you agreeing to that?
Well, I was trying to, not entirely, Your Honor. I was trying to respond to your hypothetical from earlier, like if someone was elected in November at the general, but then passed away before the January 2nd standard swear-in date. that person would have been elected to the four-year term. So there's no inconsistency in applying the vacancy provision for that specific hypothetical. We believe, and Your Honor cited to Mink versus Pua, that the use of the word successor in multiple places in 3105 tells you that it's intended to work at a standard sort of vacancy situation. We have elections to pick who serves in these offices. If someone is elected and then for whatever reason is unable to finish the term, then the vacancy thing kicks in. The provision is completely silent as to whether you can have a vacancy without ever having a predecessor. And a successor has to have a predecessor. As of January 2nd, 2019, while the Waters versus Nago proceeding was still pending before this court, there was no predecessor who could be succeeded
by someone.
But actually,
you know, the word successor, when you look at Mink versus Pua, yeah, and the definition of successor that's quoted in Mink versus Pua from Black's Law Dictionary, as well as Corpus Juris Secundum, mm-hmm, it's not limited to replacing people that are there. One who takes the place of another by succession. The term successor is variously defined as meaning, this is old language,
yeah,
he that followeth or cometh in another's place, one that succeeds or follows, one who follows into a position. Also, toward the end, a person who has appointed or elected to some office after another person.
Right.
So,
it
you
does
know,
say
I
that,
mean,
Your Honor, but I don't
Governor
believe...
Cayetano succeeded Governor Waihee, right?
I don't believe that that's the way that it's intended to work in 3105, and nor do I believe that this court's silence when it was deciding Waters versus Nago intended to create a vacancy, because this is not the only case that's going to run past the start date of a term.
Okay.
Right. So if you create, because the court said nothing about that. The court did only what was required under the election contest once it was determined that the correct result could not be determined. Now, Judge Cahill, you asked questions about was it restarting a new election? You're correct. The answer is no. We know this for sure because if you start a brand new election from the start under HRS 12-1, the primary, you must go all the way back to the beginning. So this was a do-over. It was a do-over election, and our understanding is based on the election proclamation.
But, but the statute says new election.
It does.
It doesn't say
do-over.
It doesn't say rerun. It says a new election, right?
It does say that, Your Honor, but that's describing the remedy that would be that the court would order, having concluded that the previous attempt at an election was invalid. There is no question that when the 2018 election happened, the term that was to be governed was 2019 to 2023. It's in the election proclamation. If Waters versus Nago had never happened, if it had turned out differently, if those problematic ballots had been, you know, separated, then the result would have been different. And I would submit to you that it is unsound to suggest that the result of an election contest would determine the term that the election was called to fill. So the
Ms.
term.
Maria, how is it that Mr. Waters' term was a four-year regular term that started in 2019. If somebody other than Mr. Waters served as a councilman for District 4 for part of that term,
okay, so
Mr. Fornby served part of that term as councilman for District 4.
Oh, so you're asking about that temporary appointment that
yeah,
was
so
done by
is
the
it
city?
Mr. Waters okay, was right, appointed or elected for a regular four-year
okay,
term.
So Mr. Formby was not elected at all. He was appointed to serve in the interim between the remedial election that was ordered by the court from Waters versus Nago. So he wasn't elected to any term at all. So the answer to your question is because it depends on the term for which you are elected. And because the 2019 election that happened as a consequence of this court's Waters versus Nago decision was to finish the job that the 2018 election attempted to do unsuccessfully, it was for the same term. So even though Mr. Waters was not able to, he had to win that election first. And once he did, then he could take office. The term doesn't move, and the term started without him, basically.
You think that... this is an absolutely clear and unambiguous situation in terms of how this should be interpreted in terms of the difference between the applicability of 3102 or 3105?
Well, we're spending a lot of time talking about it, so
you do concede that it is ambiguous.
It's definitely up for debate, Your Honor.
Right. But so you do concede that it is ambiguous, at least, right?
I don't think it's ambiguous. I think there is a bright line, one that Mr. Waters doesn't want to recognize.
All right, there's obviously differences of opinion.
There's definitely different points of view.
What about the principles of election laws? What about the right to vote and the right to be on the ballot? You know, Justice Okoba stated in his dissent in Clark versus Arakaoke, the right to run for elective office and the right to vote for candidates uphold a fundamental principle of our representative democracy. And he goes on, and in Akizaki versus Fong, this court stated, the fundamental interest to be protected here is that the people of the 15th representative district in choosing whomever they please to represent them in the House of Representatives. There's a lot of courts nationwide that have held that the right to vote and the right to access the ballot, if there is an ambiguity as to a candidate's eligibility, then that eligibility is to be construed in favor of allowing the person to run. So do you think that this court should not adopt those principles that have been stated by many state Supreme Courts, the last one being Alaska in 2025.
Well, I'm not familiar with those specific decisions, Your Honor, but based on your question, I think that question is not presented
Alaska
on this
Democratic
record.
Alaska Democratic Party versus Beecher, when established principles of statutory interpretation suggest a candidate is ineligible, when both interpretations regarding eligibility are reasonable, the presumption in favor of ballot access compels the reasonably possible interpretation that the candidate is eligible for re-election. So there's a lot of courts saying that, you know, that if there's a question, let the person be on the ballot and let the voters decide. Why shouldn't we follow that principle?
I don't think you have to answer that question on this record because the court has expedited this appeal and can answer the question of who's on the ballot before the general election. So you don't have to apply that here because of particular factual circumstances of this case with Mr. Ozawa's expedited application to transfer.
It's saying that the court should rule in favor of eligibility, not against eligibility. That's what the courts are saying.
Well, I understand that, but without knowing the specific facts of those cases, I'm suggesting that it wouldn't be necessary to reach that question as a broader application here because this is the end of the line, right? I mean, if the court says who is or is not on the ballot in November, that's the question is answered. So you don't need, you know, like an inclination or a legal principle that would go beyond the facts of this case. So today, you don't need to answer that question.
Well, and also, we can only pick two.
Well, correct, Your Honor.
So someone,
please don't pick three.
Someone, we would, by necessity, by law.
Correct, Your Honor. The charter
who thinks they should be on the ballot.
The charter provision, what people commonly call the runoff, is actually called the second special election by charter. And you're correct. It's advancing to two people, advancing to the November election. So both, I believe, that's court's inherent authority for purposes of the appeal, and specifically in the election contest statutes, allow the court, because this is happening after the primary, to resolve the question of who has advanced to the general election. So when you answer that question, then for purposes of this dispute, at least it will be answered.
So, and I realize this is not really the principal issue here, but in this particular case, when the challenge came, the clerk went through and looked at the paperwork, and the clerk decided that Mr. Waters is eligible based upon these dates and what occurred at a certain period of time. But in their brief, they write, page 9, as the city clerk recognizes that the two consecutive four-year term limit and the meaning of regular terms are subject to interpretation.
That was me quoting the city clerk's filing, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah.
But when the minute I see that there's an interpretation and there could be a dispute on the on a question of law, wouldn't the better remedy have been for the clerk at that time to have filed the lawsuit that's required? Because, in other words, can the legislature delegate to the clerk the interpretation of a question of law? Does it? Can the legislature even do that? And assuming they can the clerk exercise that? Because I thought only the courts could interpret
that. Well, thank you for asking that question, Your Honor. There were some questions earlier about 12-8, so I'm happy to have the opportunity to respond. Under the Alakaina Keiki case, published authority from 2012, decided by this court, the default position for the jurisdiction of the courts of this state is always that they have jurisdiction. The legislature must affirmatively and very clearly take it away if it's going to be taken away. In Alakaina Keiki, there was a statute that said that the decision of the agency was, quote, final and conclusive. The court rejected the conclusion that that was precluding appeal and then went further and decided that even if it had been precluding appeal, judicial review was still available because it would had to be protected as a matter of separation of powers and because the judicial power exists under the state constitution. So I would say the answer to your question, can the legislature make it so a single city official can determine this question of law? The answer is no. They cannot do that. They can't do it for any agency, nor do I think that would be a good idea. This is a very important issue, just like we've recognized. So if anyone's going to decide who gets to be on the ballot, it needs to be a court.
My question, though,
yes,
is when that court decision should come, because under 12-8, as we've discussed earlier, there is a very specific and tight deadline within which objections to qualification must mm-hmm. be answered. Mm-hmm. So the question, you know, under 632-1, which is the declaratory judgment action statute, mm-hmm. It provides very broad rights for parties to bring DEC actions, but it also says where, however, a statute provides a special form of remedy for a specific type of case, that statutory remedy shall be followed. Mm-hmm. So my question is, in the context of this very specific election dispute, mm-hmm. when we are pre-first special election, mm-hmm. prior to August 8th of 2026, should the 12-8 procedure have been allowed to play out, which it did, the clerk made a call, whether people agree with it or not, the clerk made a call on qualification, and should the challenge to qualification come under 11173.5 post-election? Okay. We have two cases here
right.
that are set
You've
up
got them
in both,
both right.
Procedures.
Okay, so to take it in sequence, Your Honor, I think one of Your Honor's question earlier partially answers this question, which is 12-8 is a one-sided procedure. If the clerk was going to determine that a prospective candidate for office was ineligible, they're required to get a court stamp of approval on that expedited schedule. It's not removing it from the special proceeding sentence that you read from 632-1 because it's completely silent about what happens when a city clerk determines that someone is eligible, leaving the declaratory judgment provision in place. So could the legislature do something different with 12-8? Sure, but they haven't, and it doesn't exist today and didn't exist when Mr. Ozawa filed. So, and then in terms of, like, could you resolve it afterwards? Sure. However, there is case law, the most recent City and County of Honolulu 2018 from this court, the basic premise being that if it is possible to resolve an election question before the election, then that is what should be done, which is a large part of the basis for Mr. Ozawa's emergency application to transfer. We wanted the question answered before the ballots are printed for the November election. And that was the reason that we really appreciate this court willing to consider it so quickly. So could you resolve it afterwards? Sure. But I don't know why you would want to encourage that, because it involves invalidating the result of an election. And there's a whole bunch of very compelling language in the City and County of Honolulu 2018 decision about why that's not a good idea. Invalidating an election, first of all, it requires another one, and then invalidating an election has collateral consequences that other forms of remedies do not, right? So we should try to avoid it. If it's possible to rule on an election question before the election, then that's what should be done. And that's what this court's case law holds.
just give me just a minute. I think we covered almost everything here on my notes in a very quick period here. Okay.
You know, one of the things I've been noticing in looking at section 3102, and there's been a lot of discussion about regular term mm-hmm. and the definition of regular term starting on January 2nd following the election, right? But that line that we are most focused on, that no person shall be elected to the office of council member for more than two consecutive four-year terms, the word regular doesn't appear in that line.
Yeah, it's the sentence above. And I believe my opponent's argument on that is entirely misplaced because they're taking it out of context. That full sentence says, except as provided in section 16.122, the regular terms of office for council members shall be 4 years, beginning at the 12 o'clock meridian on the second day of January following their election, okay, unquote. The except as provided in 16.122, that's the stagger provision. And if you go look at that, one time, more than 20 years ago, they did it by some kind of lot, where half of the council could only be elected for 2 years and the other for four, so that they would be staggered. And somebody had to get the short stick on that election in order to set up the stagger. So once you do it, and if you keep your terms in line, the stagger will keep working as it has. So then this reference, the regular terms of office, is saying that other than that one time when we set up the stagger, the regular terms are 4 years starting January 2nd. And we know what election they're referring to because the charter itself tells us it's referring to the regular election schedule. So as we said before, the terms don't move. They're the same. They're the same every time the council is divided. The even number seats of the 9-member council are up this year. The odd number seats are up 2028.
I understand. So your argument is the terms are the same no matter when the election takes place.
Correct, Your
Honor.
Even
if the election takes place after the term starts, the term already started. And even if someone is sitting in that position at that time, the term has already started.
Right. And the vacancy provision actually reinforces that conclusion, Your Honor, because it says to fill the unexpired term. And we know what that means because the charter explains what the terms are.
You do agree that when the charter was amended in 1992 to say two consecutive full terms, it initially said two consecutive full terms, and in 1998 it was amended to two consecutive four-year terms. That's when the staggering was brought into play. But it was the way it was explained to the voters was never an absolute limit of 8 years, correct?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that question, but
right.
I do believe that
voters were told that as long as you couldn't be elected to more than two consecutive four-year terms, full terms, it said, full terms, but if a person sat out, they could come back and be reelected.
Right. So that's the consecutive part.
Right.
I don't believe this. I'm not sure about the sequence you're talking about, Your Honor. My understanding is the stagger happened once in 2003 with the two-year terms and the four-year terms to set up the stagger.
The law was passed in 1998. The charter was amended in 1998 to allow for the staggering in the
future. Oh, okay. I understand. So the fact of the matter, though, is whatever previous iterations of this provision, what matters is what it says now. And what it says now is elected to a four-year term. And
Two consecutive four-year terms.
Right. So that means that somebody could be elected, and just leave out all the vacancies and election contests, and let's just say everything goes smoothly. Somebody could be elected to 2 4-year terms back to back, then sit out one term and go do something else, and then come back and run for another 2 consecutive 4-year terms. That is my understanding of how that could work.
Okay. Thank you.
I think that my light is supposed to be coming on, but in fact is not. So I would like to skip to my conclusion. Your Honors, Judge Ashford's decision should be promptly affirmed, and as a result, Mr. Waters' name may not appear on the ballot for the District 4 second special election to be held with the general election on November 3rd, 2026. As a result, the two candidates that should be on that ballot, which is within this court's power to determine, should be Mr. Ozawa and Ms. Gregory. And we, again, thank the court for prioritizing this matter And ask you to continue to do so and to issue a decision so that the State Office of Elections knows whose name to put on the ballot. We believe the election contest should be dismissed for the reasons stated in our response. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll now hear from Ms. Gregory.
May it please the court. Hello, Mike Kako. I'm Tara Malia Gregory. I'm running for District 4 City Council. Mahalo for the time and attention. Your Honors, I want to begin with March 8th because I believe it explains why we should never have reached this point. When I decided last year to run for City Council, I understood the Charter's two-term limitation to mean that there would be an opportunity for new leadership in District 4. I entered this race, organized a huge campaign, called off friends and family. I began doing the work necessary to earn the support of my community based upon that understanding. But questions about whether Mr. Waters could legally seek another term were already being raised publicly. My exhibits I and J document Mr. Waters himself publicly responding to questions about pushback concerning whether he could seek another term. This was well before June. So this issue was foreseeable. On March 8th, 2026, months before the ballots were mailed and months before anyone knew what the election results would be, I formally asked the acting city clerk, Office of Elections, and chief elections officer to determine Mr. Waters' eligibility, but I got no response. So this was foreseeable, and that's Exhibit A. I specifically asked for the legal authority supporting that determination, and I did that because I believe that this question needed to be resolved before voters voted and not afterwards. But it wasn't. And that matters when we talk about voter disenfranchisement. I absolutely agree that people who voted for Mr. Waters do matter. And I have evidence demonstrating that this is not a position I adopted because of where I stand in the reported election results. Exhibit U contains a public statement I made before the final outcome of my own race was known. And at that time, I specifically advocated fairness for Mr. Waters' alleged voters. When asked about the July 27th ruling, I said, it's important, I think, for Tommy's voters that they should be able to vote again. They should have nipped this at the bud last year. I was saying an eligible candidate. I also explained that resolving the issue earlier could have opened the race to other candidates, so it does change everything. That was my position then, and my concern for those voters remains the same today, all voters. But I believe we have to be careful about where the disenfranchisement actually occurred. If Mr. Waters was legally ineligible, the confusion did not begin when the circuit court enforced the charter. The problem arose because voters were presented with a candidate whose eligibility remained unresolved, even though the issue had been publicly raised and formally presented to the election officials months before voting. And my evidence demonstrates why we should not simply assume what every person who voted for Mr. Waters when they voted for him would have done had that eligibility question been resolved beforehand. Exhibit Q provides a concrete example of that. A voter contacted me after she and her mother had already voted early, July 31st. After subsequently learning more about me as a candidate, she told me that both she and her mother wanted to change their votes to me. I want to be very clear about why I offer that evidence. I'm not saying that every August 8th Waters voter would have voted for me. I can't make that claim. And I'm not asking this court to speculate about whose voters would have selected, who they would have selected. I do offer it for a much more powerful proposition. A ballot cast early tells us that a voter chooses that particular person at that particular moment with the information that voter had at that particular time. It does not necessarily establish what that same voter would have chosen with different information or from a field consisting of only candidates legally eligible to serve. My voter questionnaires and declarations further document the confusion. If you look at Exhibit T, my collection is that Judge Ashford considered the voters' decisions concerning term limits and explained in substance that Mr. Waters' approximately 7.5 years of service was closer to 8 years than 12. If Mr. Waters is permitted another term through 2031, well, that practically results in nearly 12 consecutive years in the city council seat. despite the voters having imposed a 2 consecutive term limit.
Ms. Gregory, you are aware that there are other council members after the amendments that have served more than 8 consecutive years.
Yes, I am aware of those. All right, I am aware. And I do agree with the arguments presented regarding that.
Thank you.
But I do formally raise it with the election officials from March 8th. And I want to bring March 8th into the conversation merely because we're consistently talking about it was too late, it wasn't timely. But as a candidate, the type of harm and standing that I do have in this case, especially with being able to be removed from a case, I would like the opportunity to be consistent with what's been argued today regarding that. So, and in closing, votes cannot create legal eligibility where the charter does not provide it, and I do agree with what's been spoken of today. And so I respectfully ask the court to affirm the circuit court's determination that Mr. Waters is ineligible to be elected to the District 4 Council seat for 2731. The voters do deserve clarity, and that's why I wanted to speak on behalf of them today, not just a specific group of voters, but all voters. So mahalo for the time.
Thank you very much. We will now hear rebuttal from Mr. Stewart.
Thank you so much. I guess I'd like to start by noting that the distinction that was made by Mr. Ozawa's counsel regarding the interpretation of 3-105 relies on language that's simply not in the charter. There is no distinction as to how many candidates there may be in the election, or that a replacement term or a successor term somehow is distinct from that initially served by Mr. Waters starting in 2019. I think that's consistent with the court's holding in Mink versus Pua, which also doesn't delineate what a successor means as following somebody in the same term, but just somebody who follows another person. And to harmonize those two together, I think you need to consider that there is no real distinction between how, you know, Councilmember Fukunaga, Councilmember Anderson, and Councilmember Kobayashi, their initial partial terms were handled. They were elected in the middle of the same 4-year term. Regardless of how much time was left on that term, we know it wasn't a 4-year term. And even Mr. Ozawa's counsel doesn't dispute that. But to say that there is somehow a difference between what happened here in 2019 with Mr. Waters and what happened with those 3 prior council members is to impute or to revise the language of 3102 and 3105. In fact, if you look at the election in November of 2018, at the end of the counting, Mr. Ozawa had the most votes. Had Mr. Waters not filed the election challenge, presumably Mr. Ozawa would have been.
Who are you arguing that Mr. Waters succeeded in 2019?
He would have succeeded in terms of service. He would have succeeded Mr. Formby. But in terms of his term, the prior elected individual would have been Mr. Ozawa on his prior term. So had Mr. Waters not challenged the results of the November 2018 election, Mr. Ozawa would have been certified as the winner. There's no question that Mr. Waters didn't win that election.
And then if this court on January 19th had upheld the general election, then Mr. Ozawa's term would have started as of January 2nd because he was elected.
Presumably so.
To a 4-year term.
Presumably so, which undercuts, I think, Mr. Ozawa's argument that all that matters is the election, because in this case, when is the election complete? Is it at the point of the certification, at the point of the swearing in, et cetera, which I think gets back to your prior hypothetical, because in 2018, again, if Mr. Waters had brought the initial challenge, then presumably Mr. Ozawa was elected, or at least until the challenge was brought and until this court ruled, Mr. Ozawa was the presumptive
elected. What would have happened if Mr. Waters had actually won the 2018 general and Mr. Ozawa had challenged on the same basis as Mr. Waters?
I think we'd be in the exact same spot.
Yeah. And then in a special election in April of 2019, Mr. Waters was elected. In that situation, would you think that Mr. Waters was elected to a four-year term? Let's say that Mr. Waters won the general election in 2018. Mr. Ozawa challenged on the same basis as Mr. Waters. This court rules on January 25th, 2019, that there has to be a new election. In the new election on April 19th, Mr. Waters wins again, all right? Would Mr. Waters have been elected to a four-year term under those circumstances?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Because the election results of November 2018 were invalidated.
Correct.
So it is a new election.
Yes, that's exactly how we see it. And we do believe that that's a bright line, clean interpretation that doesn't require any kind of contortion.
So Mr. Stewart, anytime there is an election challenge and this court's decision, which, you know, we're talking about an election in November, this court came out with a decision 2 months later, probably I think less than 2 months later in January of 2019. So anytime there's essentially an election challenge and you are not able to get a decision by this court before January 2nd of the following year, whoever gets certified in that new election gets a pass in terms of whether that term counts for the term limit. Is that essentially what your position is?
I think
is?
That that is, for lack of a better term, a consequence that you have by literally interpreting the plain language of 3-102. I think that's correct. That if the court orders a special election, I disagree as to if the court were to deny the election contest and the fact that somebody was sworn in, but their election results stood from the original November election. I would distinguish.
I don't think
those.
People get sworn in when there's an election challenge pending.
No, I understand that. I'm saying had they been elected, but then this court dismissed the challenge, and then that same person who'd been elected in November gets sworn in at some later date after this court rules, then I don't see how you would argue that you've been elected in the term. Now, again, that goes to service, not election. In this case, I think the first election, the time that the person is elected the first time, starts the clock on that. I think that's the simple and the only logical explanation. Mm-hmm. So I see that I'm out of time. I guess I would, if I may have 20 more seconds, just to note the point that regarding the narrow interpretation of election matters, that issue has been raised by this court going back to territorial days in Hollinger versus Kumule, 25 Hawaii 669, where the court said, statutes providing for disqualifications of citizens for election to office are construed strictly and will not be extended to cases not clearly within their scope. Also, Cobb versus State by Watanabe, 68 Hawaii 564, where again, the court advocated a narrow reading in terms of anything that would restrict the ability of either a candidate to seek office or the voters to support that candidate. In this case, we know more than 8,000 people, notwithstanding the ruling of the circuit court, which occurred right in the heart of voting, but more than 8,000 people supported this candidate. And we believe that their voices should be heard. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Otake?
Try to keep this brief. Just I want to address a couple of things. Your Honor, Judge Cahill, the question, can the legislature delegate to a clerk the interpretation of law? It's a very actually complicated issue that I spent a lot of time looking into. There's an interplay between when you have a private right of action, there's an interplay between, I suggest we look at the Whitey's boat cruise case, and we look at the Keiki versus Mariyoshi case and the Shopo versus City and County of Honolulu case and the Travelers Insurance versus Hawaii Roofing. And when you look at all of that, the Travelers Insurance versus Hawaii Roofing, I would submit, is very similar to this situation. And so I agree with you. That seems concerning, but the legislature and Justice Sakoba in Keiki versus Mariyoshi and some of the other justices, they really laid out when that's actually okay on occasion, so long as, but anyway, I think it's a very complicated issue. It's an interplay between 12-8, 632-1.
I agree. It was just an observation is that.
I understand. And I understand.
It's of concern that a clerk on a question of law is making a decision that has this huge impact for all of the people.
And I will agree with you. When I read that and I saw that, I had, you know, just by our nature, we had that concern. But when I really dove into it, it made a lot of sense why in this case it's okay.
Justice Ginoza is suggesting is, but that, even if it was not wise, it can be corrected now in the election challenge.
Except in this case, the time to file that election challenge has passed. But in any event, I want to just end by saying this. I mean, if there's one thing that we've learned today is that this probably is up for debate. It probably is. I think it's, the plain language supports us, especially the part, as Your Honor pointed out, on the second day of January following the election, I think the plain language is in our favor. To the degree it's up for debate, I'm here on behalf of the 40 people that I'm representing, voters. I'm here to say let the voters decide. Let's err on the side of democracy, especially here in Hawaii. You mentioned the many states that do that, Alaska and others. Let's do that here.
But what about Ms. Gregory's?
For what it's worth, I'll say this, under our complaint, 11-372, right. Because we're suggesting it changed the result, right. that's the case, that we have to argue that. But I've never suggested that the court couldn't just do a do-over, and let everybody run again. That's another possibility. I respectfully to Ms. Gregory. I just want to end by saying this. I'm a lifelong resident of the district, grew up in Kaimuki, and it does. I mean this. There's three people here who want to serve, and that's a good thing. And, however this comes out, whoever wins, we come together and for the benefit of the district and our community. And just thank you guys for your time today.
But by the way, when you said a do-over, I looked over at council for Mr. Mago. I'm not so sure they're in agreement with that position. Yeah.
The point is there are remedies and there are options. The option of 8,654 voters being disenfranchised is not one of them. Thank you.
Thank you. This court will take this matter under advisement. This court will rule expeditiously by this Friday's deadline.
Iku iluna, please rise. Ua o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha o kolokolo ki ike hanahano o kamoko aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.